Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations are tax deductible and go directly to the costs associated with podcast production. Donations may also go towards research, material development, and counseling costs for those who can't afford them. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the promotion of health and general well-being for Mormons and their families. To support the podcast and its efforts, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I'm just thrilled to have two very special guests with me on the program. I'm going to give a brief introduction and kind of an introduction of the topic that we'll be discussing and then turn the time over to them to further their own introductions. But I have Elliot Kennedy, who's an attorney and the special expert for LGBT affairs in the Department of Health and Human Services at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which from here on out I will just call as SAMHSA. His work focuses on planning and coordinating LGBT policy and programmatic initiatives, as well as integrating LGBT cultural competency throughout the agency. He also serves as staff for the Health and Human Services LGBT Issues Coordinating Committee. He was previously Government Affairs Counsel at the Trevor Project, which many in my audience might know about. We've pushed that a lot as far as part of the resources for LGBT members in our congregations, where he advocated for laws and regulations that support LGBTQ youth and young adult mental health. Among other areas, his work has focused on access to mental health services, safe and supportive educational environments, and ending youth homelessness. So welcome, Elliot, to the program.
Thank you very much.
And then we have Dr. Judith Glassgold. She's the Associate Executive Director and Director of Government Relations for Public Interest Directorate of the American Psychological Association, which is also known as the APA. And prior to coming to the APA, she worked on health policy in the Congressional Research Service. She served as Senior Policy Advisor on Domestic Social Policy and has worked on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and unemployment policies. She's a clinical psychologist and an expert in sexual orientation and gender identity. She was chair of the APA Task Force on Appropriate Therapeutic Responses to Sexual Orientation and served as president of Division 44, the Society for Psychological Study of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Issues. She's also been the chair of the APA's Committee on Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Issues and has served in leadership positions in her state psychological association, serving as president of the New Jersey Psychological Association member and chair of the Ethics Committee. She's authored over 20 publications on sexual orientation and gender identity and presented extensively on these issues to professional and community organizations. So welcome to you, Dr. Glassgold.
Thank you. So good to be here today.
Yeah, and we are going to be talking about this new report that was recently released by SAMHSA called Ending Conversion Therapy, Supporting and Affirming LGBTQ Youth. And this is a really important topic, I think, especially for our LDS population, because the church has had a long history with indirect support of conversion therapies, with studies and research being held at BYU back in the 70s and even 80s, and relationships, indirect relationships with organizations such as Evergreen and even some of the work that LDS Family Services has been involved with. And although we've seen a kind of shift away from that probably in the last 15 to 20 years within the LDS church and a recognition that sexual orientation is not something that members choose, that, you know, there has been a move from church leadership saying this is probably something that's more innate and something that's more complicated than just a choice, which has been really healthy. These reparative therapies are still, you know, interwoven within our culture and our folklore and even in our practices. In fact, there was just a story just this last week with a therapist who was going to give a presentation at BYU Idaho regarding being able to change your sexual orientation, and that was canceled due to the backlash that once that was made public, but that they received with that. So you can see how this is still very much an issue within our culture. So I'm just super excited to talk about this because it's so important for the health of so many people within our own membership and obviously the population at large. So with that introduction of the topic, do either one of you want to just spend a little bit more time and tell me a little bit about how you got involved with this project, and even if you want to speak a little bit more about yourselves?
I'm happy to kick it off. So this is Elliot Kennedy with SAMHSA. We decided that we wanted to put out a report on this topic, in part because of increased national attention to the issue, state legislative actions around the country. And then in April, following the death by suicide of a transgender girl, there was a huge outpouring of support for some federal statement against conversion therapy, recognizing the harm that it was doing to LGBTQ youth. And so the administration, in early April, put out a statement condemning conversion therapy for minors and indicating that it would support efforts to ban it. So SAMHSA is the agency responsible for advancing the behavioral health of the nation, and we really felt that it was important to put out sort of a robust science-based resource for providers and for families who are looking for accurate information. So what does the research say? What are clinicians doing? And how can we best support LGBTQ youth? So we recognizing that sort of we serve as conveners, but don't have the expertise internally to our agency. We partnered with the American Psychological Association, and I'm going to turn it over to Judith to sort of talk a little bit about the convening that they pulled together to really serve as the foundation for this report.
Thanks, Elliot. First of all, I just want to say a little bit about what brought me to this topic. When I was a clinician working in the community, I saw many people who struggled to figure out how to be LGBT and remain within their faith. And families who were very confused about, you know, why is my child gay? Are they gay? What does this mean for their future? So as a clinician, I worked for, a couple decades on these topics and found that, you know, families really truly care about their children and they're very confused about what's going on and they really need accurate information. So I worked very hard in this area, especially given that, you know, in my own family, which has some members who are Orthodox Jews, it really is troubling when your faith and your sexual orientation seem to collide. And we were very pleased here at the American Psychological Association when SAMHSA and Elliot in particular approached us to try to do more to develop the scientific basis for explaining to families, children, policymakers, therapists, religious leaders, whether conversion therapy is effective, first of all, with children and youth, whether it's harmful, and what therapists and faith leaders should do to help children and their families cope and adjust when there's a coming out in the family. So we wanted to sort of write the final page on whether conversion therapy is safe and effective, which it isn't, and then really help parents, therapists, families sort of come to terms and figure out, well, what kind of therapy should we take our child to and what would be helpful for them? Because we believe that families really want to support their children. So we're really glad that this report came out and that we were able to bring together scientific experts, both clinicians and researchers, to come up with, I think, some guiding principles for this type of work.
Thank you. So let's start a little bit with some of the challenges that families are facing, and in particular LGBT youth who are having to deal with the, reactions of their families as they are trying to come out or trying to be more authentic about how they feel about their lives. I know that in our population, we oftentimes have LGBT youth who have not necessarily even entered what you'd call the lifestyle, quote unquote. In other words, they don't have necessarily a boyfriend or girlfriend yet, or they don't, they haven't become sexually active, but just the fact that they're saying, hey, I might have this attraction, or I might have this issue where I feel different, or I might have, you know, some issues with my gender identity, even just the talking of it can really start this familial kind of crisis that oftentimes leaves, I don't want to say often, but at times can leave these youth homeless, kicked out of their homes, or even facing ecclesiastical disciplinary courses, you know, through our church. So just really traumatic, I think, for, like you're saying, all involved, not just the kids, but the families and the parents and the leaders who don't, I think, have good intentions, but not always are good intentions translated to healthy actions for all involved. So what are some of the things that you know about families who are facing these issues as far as statistics or LGBT youth in of themselves, as far as how's their mental health affected? How's whether or not family rejection or acceptance is part of that overlay, et cetera?
That's a great question. And I think you raised really good points that sort of both from the perspective of family health and keeping healthy families together, and also from the perspective of ensuring long-term health and well-being for LGBTQ youth, this is really a prime point where we can intervene and sort of help prevent a lot of heartbreak. So I would be remiss if I didn't highlight the work of Dr. Caitlin Ryan from the Family Acceptance Project, who has really spent a lot of very careful time working with families, particularly in faith-based communities, to understand sort of the science behind what youth experience as family rejection and how that affects their long-term behavioral health. So just to give you a few statistics that we have, Caitlin's work has sort of measured a huge range of behaviors that children are experiencing in the family, and mapped them out against sort of like on a scale of rejecting to accepting, and then sort of what did that do for the behavioral health. So one of the more interesting findings is that compared with peers from families with no or low levels of family rejection, lesbian, gay, bisexual young adults who reported higher levels of family rejection during adolescence were 8.4 times more likely to report having attempted suicide, 5.9 times more likely to report high levels of depression, 3.4 times more likely to report illegal drug use, and 3.4 times more likely to report having engaged in unprotected sexual intercourse. And she found that even if you just moved the needle a little bit from an extremely rejecting family to a moderately rejecting family experience, those numbers dropped dramatically. So I think I would let both Judith or Dr. Ryan speak to her work more, but she's really demonstrated that you don't have to shift a family's values. Just sort of, if you can shift behaviors slightly, you can really ameliorate a lot of the negative outcomes for LGBTQ youth. And just to add a little bit of context, one of the other reasons that we felt it was really important, and continue to feel that it's important to produce resources to support and affirm LGBTQ youth, is that we see across a range of lifetime experiences just significant disparities in outcomes. So, for example, LGBTQ youth, as you mentioned, are estimates are that they represent maybe 5 to 7% of the general population, although that is a changing estimate as youth come out at younger and younger ages. But they represent up to 40% of the homeless youth population. Similarly, they're overrepresented in juvenile justice systems. They are overrepresented in foster care systems, and within foster care systems, they change families more often than non-LGBTQ youth. And also, they experience significant levels of mistreatment in school. So the majority of LGBTQ youth report having been victimized, harassed, or bullied in school. So it's a vulnerable population, and we're trying to do everything we can to help ensure their health and well-being.
Yeah, those are really sobering statistics. And I know that I currently serve as the president for the Mormon Mental Health Association, and we had Dr. Ryan come in for this year's conference. She's our keynote speaker and did an excellent job, and I plan to have her on this podcast as well to talk a little bit more about exactly what you're discussing and this notion of highly rejection versus moderate rejection. You know, whereas high rejection could be, you know, you can't live in our home anymore, we're going to not have contact with you anymore, you know, things of that nature, versus moderate rejection. I assume that means we may not believe in the choices that you're making, or we may not agree with your position about this, but at the same time, you're still welcome in our home. We're still going to love you. We're still going to call you our child and be loving towards you. Is that a good way to kind of describe those two terms you mentioned?
I think so. I think, you know, I think that's a very good way to describe it, is that, you know, the highly rejecting is the sort of absolute severing of ties, of parental ties of concern. And that, I think, is what's the most dangerous. And I think, you know, Dr. Ryan's work and others stresses that a family doesn't have to give up their faith beliefs in order to move the dial back in terms of rejecting behaviors. You don't have to necessarily agree that you want your child to be LGB or T, but I think it's more that you don't act in ways that are experienced as rejecting, traumatic. I mean, as Eliot states, already these children face societal rejection, rejection from their peers and community. So they really do need their parents' love, and they need the protective functions that families provide. And families still can play such a big and meaningful role in their development and can really make the difference on the ultimate psychological outcome in terms of do their child have self-esteem? Are their children depressed? Are their children, you know, function in the world in terms of school and work? So families still play a very important role. And I think for most children, their sexual orientation and gender identity is an evolution. So families don't have to jump the gun. And I think it's going to be a work in progress that open communication and support can play a very big role in positive outcomes.
Yeah, and it's interesting, as you're both talking, you know, a big part of our culture in Mormonism is not just the immediate family. I mean, that's a huge part of, you know, our just emphasis is family living, but we also have this notion of ward families, you know, and the community is the congregation is a family in of its own. And it's interesting, as you're talking, it's just reminding me, I'm sure you've heard about the issues that have recently happened within our culture with these new policies that came out on November 5th, I believe it was, about making, you know, same gender marriage part of what's considered apostasy. And so we have kind of this weird relationship with this rejection piece, because on the one hand, we've had a lot of messages coming from the pulpit and from the leaders saying, you know, we need to be, even if we consider homosexual behavior a sin, which is in of itself, we have a weird relationship with this, right? Because we don't consider homosexuality a sin, but if you're going to act on homosexuality by acting in your behavior, which is sexual, then that's when it's considered a sin by the church. But there's been all these messages about being loving and being accepting and, you know, welcoming LGBT members of the Mormon community into our congregations. But on the other hand, now, you know, we have this apostasy policy in place, which means that LGBT members will be facing quite severe rejection type processes like excommunication or disfellowship, or, you know, not being able to really enjoy the same benefits that all the other members will enjoy. And so you can see the issues that we're facing even within our very own wider family culture that I think some of these things apply to as well. It's not just the immediate family, it's the community family.
Yeah, that's a real challenge. And, you know, social exclusion and community rejection are such powerfully negative things. And I would never presume to tell a faith, you know, anything about their faith, but from a psychological perspective, I'm not sure that ends up helping the individual or the community. I've seen this in my own practice with a number of faiths that, you know, remaining connected and dialoguing in a respectful way, and remembering that most faiths are about mercy, compassion, love. Those are the founding and hope, and those are the fundamental principles, the higher principles of so many faiths, and those are very psychologically healing precepts when people can act in those ways, in ways that sort of express those values. Whereas, you know, rejection, hatred, disgust, those things are so damaging both to the individual being rejected, but also to the community, as I think it takes us all away from those higher values that we try to embrace as human beings.
Yeah, and it almost serves as like an example of the church, you know, if the church leaders think it's okay to reject people from the congregations, then why isn't it okay for me as a parent to reject my child, you know, from my home, or to, if the church believes it's protective by doing these policies, then how is that any different from me as a parent being protective of my home and maybe other siblings, you know, or things of that nature? And so that's where I think it's just really hurtful as an example of how we can treat each other in our own families and wards. So yeah, it's a real, we're kind of in, not that either one of you are Mormon, but we're kind of in our own little Mormon fiasco right now these last few weeks. And, mm-hmm. and in case you haven't noticed, dude, it's all over the news. So I'm sure you have.
Yeah, and I think children are, I just want to say that, you know, it's hard enough for an adult to be excluded and excommunicated. But I think for a child, they're so vulnerable. All children are vulnerable, and all children are dependent on adults to help them survive in our world, to learn some skills. And I think it is so damaging emotionally for a child to be rejected or abused or to feel that they are unworthy of their family's love or their community's love or of their divine being's love. And so I think, you know, again, children's sexual orientation and gender identity evolve over many, many years. I think that we know that efforts to change them via therapy or talk therapy or prayer won't help and can cause damage. So we all are called upon then to find other solutions. And those solutions usually are conversations that are respectful, expressing love, helping children with the normal daily things that you want to teach them, you know, help them with their schoolwork, teach them how to be a loving human being. And I think when you focus on that, the other things eventually evolve and in many ways work themselves out. And I think it's so important for families not to focus on their faith's prohibitions, but again, to focus on the higher values of forgiveness, mercy, love, and to remember that they play such an important role in making sure their child doesn't become suicidal, doesn't get involved in substance abuse, doesn't become homeless, that their love and compassion can make such a difference in their child's life.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think, I'm so glad that you're having this conversation and this podcast now, just like, I think given the recent announcement, this is likely a really risky time for LGBTQ youth in the Mormon community, whether because they are sort of losing hope in long-term aspirations of being able to, you know, stay within their faith and their family, or even if they're not experiencing family rejection, maybe it's fear of rejection, and maybe this is sort of visible example of a community that they're afraid that they can't be a part of. So I do hope that, you know, conversations like this can give you know, Mormon children hope and also give their families information to help support them.
Yeah, I agree, because I think that even in the wake of this policy, the way that it was written towards adults, you know, who are living in same-gender marriages, our same-sex marriages, but what we forget oftentimes is that children and youth are listening to the things that are happening for the adults, right? So it's naive to think that this isn't affecting LGBT youth as well, even though they may not be in that time of their lives where they're directly affected, but they're very much indirectly affected by these policies, for sure. Okay, so let's move on to some of the key findings that you're referring to, specifically these two that I'd like to talk about a little bit more. One is that the variations in sexual orientation and gender identity and gender expression are normal parts of human behavior. And that's, you know, that's, I think, a pretty important finding and something that hasn't really, even in our overall culture, hasn't always been around. I mean, homosexuality used to be classified as a disorder, even in the psychology books. So we have a history, you know, of having to kind of rethink our ways of dealing with these issues, even in our overall culture. And then secondly is this thing that you've mentioned several times now, that conversion therapy is not effective and actually can be harmful. So can we talk about those two findings in particular and more in detail?
Sure. And Elliot, feel free to jump in. So, you know, the American Psychological Association has been looking into this issue about sexual orientation and gender identity and what is normal for now decades. And the research all points to that it doesn't matter what kind of sexual orientation or gender identity you have, because you can function and be in the world as a complete human being without difference. So there is no differences in the functioning and outcome and capabilities of people with a diverse set of sexual orientations and gender identities. You know, people come in all sorts of sizes and shapes and all sorts of variations in so many ways, and sexual orientation and gender identity are just part of that. And, you know, homosexuality and gender identity variations or gender diversity and same-sex attractions are part of a human spectrum of sexuality and gender identity. And I think we've been much too locked into binary models that put us in one or the other, and either straight or gay or male or female, and people are much more diverse. And these binary models really don't fit how human beings are, and human beings can feel trapped and unhappy when they're faced with trying to conform to those models. Elliot, do you have anything you want to add from SAMHSA's perspective?
Yeah, I would add, I think part of the reason that this for us is such an important key finding is that it includes gender identity and gender expression, which is not something that I think has been as central to the evolving conversations in this area. But particularly with respect to children and adolescents, it's really important because often it's gender nonconformity that's the first thing that families can start to struggle with. I think there is more leeway for what we would call tomboys, I guess, you know, girls dressing up as boys, violating whatever people think of as stereotypes for little girls. But there's a lot less forgiveness often in communities for feminine boys. So I think I just wanted to highlight that sort of that variation expression is normal and is also sort of the root of a lot of distress that we see in families around children and adolescents.
And could I have both of you or one of you just kind of define these terms further? I know that oftentimes when we're all seeped into these issues, we're very comfortable with these terms such as sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, but these might be new terms that need a little bit more clarifying for some in my audience.
So I'll take sexual orientation, and maybe Elliot can split it with me and take gender identity and expression.
That works.
So I think sexual orientation, the way I see it and the way we see it, is who you are sexually attracted to, but even more so, who you fall in love with and what the gender of that person is. So are you attracted to men? Are you attracted to women? Are you attracted to both? Do you fall in love with women or men or both? So if you fall in love with someone of the same gender as you, you are gay. If you fall in love with someone who's the other gender, another gender, you are straight. And if you fall in love with all people, doesn't matter what their gender is, you're bisexual. And it really encompasses both the sexual attraction and also a deep emotional attraction that we consider love and sort of a deep bonding of individuals to each other.
And for gender identity, I would say it's a person's internal sense of what their gender is, which is distinct from what we call sex assigned at birth, which is sort of the sex that the doctor put on your birth certificate. So, for example, when I was born, the doctor put an F on my birth certificate for female, but I identify as male, so I'm a transgender man. My gender identity is male. Gender expression is more about our outward appearances and actions. So that's the spectrum of what we think of as masculinity to femininity. So you could be a person who's not transgender and not gay, and you have a gender expression just like everyone else does. It's just the way that you exist in the world, present yourself to the world. So a feminine boy or a masculine girl might be someone that we consider gender non-conforming, because society expects that girls will typically be feminine and boys will typically be masculine.
And you could have a very masculine looking girl who enjoys looking masculine, but she's very comfortable with her gender identity as a girl. In other words, she doesn't feel like a boy. She just likes to dress like, masculine, and reverse.
And that same girl could be attracted to men in terms of her sexual orientation. So gender identity expression and sexual orientation are separate, and you can get all sorts of combinations of someone who identifies as transgender but maybe is heterosexual. Variation is the norm, and creative variation, and we should celebrate those differences because they're part of, I think, the unique creativity of love within human beings.
Well, and I really appreciate, too, Judith, that you talked about not only kind of sexual attraction but romantic attraction, because I think that most of us would very much agree that relationship and romance and having a committed relationship in one's life for most people is something that's sought out for and healthy and considered positive well-being. And that's one of the stances that I've taken kind of against my own church's position right now, is that really the only way to be, because they're saying, yeah, we agree that homosexuality is not a choice and it's not a sin, but we do believe that behavior is, then the expectation to be a righteous Mormon if you're gay or lesbian is that you're going to be a celibate member. And I think that that's a very unhealthy expectation to place, because it's not just about sexual acts. It's about this romantic relationship and this desire to bond with another human being at a level that most of us have.
That's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up. I think, oftentimes people of traditional faiths are forced to choose between being terribly alone and their faith. That basically if you want to be faithful, you must be alone. And as human beings, we're really not meant to be alone and by ourselves. We're meant to live in families and be part of communities and express our love to each other. And that's often, love is, there are all these love songs for a reason in the world, because it fulfills our, I think, deepest nature. So it's often very cruel for people to have to choose between their spiritual lives, which are tremendously meaningful, and their love for other human beings. And not that people can't do that, but I think it's terribly harsh and oftentimes doesn't work. Or you have another scenario where someone feels that, well, I'll get married to someone of the other sex, and then they can't provide their partner that type of love. And they're just doing it to fit in, and their spouse gets cheated of that very special emotion. And they're forced to live a lie, and most faiths believe that lies are wrong. So we really shouldn't expect people to either be alone or to lie. This is an intolerable situation for most individuals.
Yeah, and given our history in Mormonism up till about, again, about 15 years ago, that was the advice that was given by ecclesiastical leaders to anyone who would present in their offices with same-sex attraction issues that, well, you know, just, you know, kind of like you said, pray and ask the Lord for help and marry, you know, a person heterosexually, and it'll all work out, you know, even if it's in the next life, it'll all work out. And that has really set up now for a lot of people that I see in my practice, which are now, you know, 20 years into those marriages and divorcing or having to co-parent. And it really hasn't, you know, worked out. I think that there's some new research coming out of Utah State University that talks about those marriages maybe having 75% divorce rates, somewhere around there. So that's still kind of in the works, but that's difficult. It's a really difficult position to be in.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's contrary to what we know as mental health professionals about what's healthy. You know, you want someone to be able to grow up and find their way and be true to themselves and find and create a family with someone they can truly love. And we're really stacking the odds against individuals and their families if we put these additional pressures on them to be who they're not or pretend or, you know, it always has negative outcomes for the individual, the family, and the community.
Okay, do we want to move to then this finding about conversion therapy in of itself not being effective? It's been around forever and all different types of even a spectrum of conversion therapy from, you know, actually shocking people as they watch, you know, homosexual images to maybe more talk therapy approaches, which aren't quite as, I think, directly grievous. So there's a large history of the types of conversion therapies out there and just the effectiveness that we've seen over probably the last 50 years in those attempts. So can both of you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'll start off and then Elliot can chime in, I hope. There is no evidence that conversion therapy is effective. And in fact, there's evidence that it's harmful. You know, it has been around forever, and, you know, despite claims that it is effective, those claims have not held up under scrutiny by independent researchers. Sometimes people maybe change what they call themselves, but their patterns of sexual attraction and emotional desire and love really do not change. So, you know, maybe they get married, but really their sexual orientation doesn't change. And what's even more troubling is that it's harmful. People who've been through conversion therapy have higher rates of suicide, depression, anxiety, substance abuse. In some individuals, it can lead to, you know, really terrible outcomes like suicidality. So, you know, it's not effective and it can be harmful and the risks are really too great. I mean, And we feel very strongly that therapists should only offer treatments to individuals that are effective, that are helpful. And there are treatments that can help someone resolve their conflicts between faith and sexual orientation and gender identity expression without involving these types of harmful interventions, whether they're prayer, behavioral interventions, or anything like that. They're just harmful and really shouldn't be done.
Yeah, I think Judith hit the nail on the head. And actually, I think one thing that you had said previously, Judith, that always struck me was, and we ended up putting it in the report, is that informed consent is not possible for a service that does not provide a benefit. I just think, you know, when we say that there's no evidence that conversion therapy is effective, it's not because we're seeking additional evidence. It's because it's a harmful practice.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that, by informed consent, Elliot?
I actually am going to ask Judith to elaborate on that because it came from her originally, but I think it's a great line.
Well, when you sit down as a healthcare provider and you provide someone a treatment, you, based on, you know, healthcare ethics, need to inform them of the risks and the benefits. And with most legitimate treatments, you can talk about benefits, like, if I were going to go to a doctor and get my appendix taken out, the benefit would be I'd get my infected appendix taken out. Of course, with any healthcare practice, there are risks, and the risks with an appendix, moving your appendix, is there's a general risk to surgery, going under anesthesia, things like that. But generally, you can say that the benefits outweigh the risks. With conversion therapy, there are no benefits. So you really can't offer anyone informed consent because the only thing there are risks. There is no benefit to it, and in fact, there's a danger of harm. So you can't really go through the normal process of engaging someone in treatment because, I mean, you can say this, it isn't a treatment because it can't improve your life. There are, again, alternatives. I mean, sometimes people are so lonely or isolated, just talking to any therapist helps, but that isn't conversion therapy. I mean, people need support. They need our understanding, but they should get that from someone who isn't trying to change their sexual orientation or gender identity expression and who doesn't promise them things that they can't deliver.
Yeah, and I would say, too, that part of my experience with those that would say, oh, but there are cases where it has worked, is that oftentimes, like when you were talking earlier about the sexual orientation spectrum and that, you know, maybe not everybody has heard of the Kinsey scale, but that's something that you can quickly Google and see how there's this kind of spectrum between being attracted to the same gender versus the opposite gender. And so some people who maybe fall more in the middle ranges, to your point, being called bisexual, can make it work with either gender. And so I think a lot of times those people don't realize that they're bisexual, that they just think, oh yeah, look at me, I've changed, you know, or other people will perceive them as having changed because they know that they've struggled with, I hate the word even struggle, that they've experienced same-sex attraction. And then, but now they're in a heterosexual relationship. And so that, you know, can kind of have that confirmation bias of, well, see, it worked for so-and-so, right? So why can't it work for you? Especially if you're my kid or my, you know, my friend or my person that I'm concerned about. And so there's that cultural pressure. And I think the other thing that happens too is that when people get into this kind of shame failure cycle that I've seen clients of my own get involved with, it's almost like they have to convince themselves that it's working. And they can do that for years, you know, before there's kind of another crisis that hits. And that can be really just traumatic to see that because it's almost like you have to lie to yourself and convince yourself that this is working. And I just see that really not go well for people either. So
those are great points. No, I'm glad you brought that up. I think sometimes when people start down a road, they do so out of fear and terror because they think, I have to do this because the alternative, you know, being LGBT is just too terrifying. And once you're somewhat invested, it's hard to turn around and say, I've wasted this time or what will I do? And oftentimes people don't have images of hope. I mean, how can I stay connected to faith somehow and be LGBTQ? They often don't know how to do that. And I think part of the affirmative therapy model that we talk about in this report and elsewhere is that it's so important for the therapist to help someone take a pause and explore both their sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression without any sort of a priori assumptions about what the outcome will be. And also to the same with faith, to really understand their faith, what their faith means at the higher level in terms of core values, and try to develop an integrated perspective, not to focus on either or, and also to be open-ended about what the outcome will be. I mean, I never know how someone will live their life in the end and what decisions they'll make. I'm just hoping to take away the stigma and shame they feel about same-sex attractions and diverse gender identities and expressions so that if they're bisexual, they can feel whole, even if they're in a heterosexual relationship, or if they decide to be transgender, they can feel good about who they are. But how someone goes out and lives their life in the end is their decision. but we should try to support them in being true to themselves rather than on one specific outcome. And I think that's true for faith as well, as faith evolves over a lifetime and is very deep and nuanced. And I think we have to be really open to people feeling empowered to go deeper into their both their spirituality as well as their own personal identity.
Yeah, and I would add, it's important, a lot of the work that we looked at when we were putting this report together really highlighted family distress as sort of the source of a lot of the issues that were coming up. And I think it's really important, if we're talking about a supportive and affirming model, to do that in a way that recognizes that this can be a struggle for families, and it is sometimes shifting cultural norms for them as well. And you know, this was something that came up in my own transition, was sort of recognizing that me transitioning affected my family, and they needed as much help sort of exploring what that would look like for them moving forward as I did. And I think just sort of keeping the family unit in mind as a collection of people, all of whom are going through some kind of shift together, can be helpful.
Yeah, I love that. That's a very systemic approach. And I think that you're absolutely right. Everybody, it's a shift in everybody's expectations. And oftentimes there's grieving that needs to be done for just, I mean, this is true of any issue. When you expect things to work out a certain way and they don't, there's some grieving involved in that, right? And having the tools to appropriately do that without shattering the family relationships, I think, is really important.
Oh, that's a wonderful point. And I think being able to grieve together can pull a family together. But sometimes, as you know, Natasha, grief comes out as anger. And confusion can be expressed in angry ways, because sometimes people are scared of their own sadness and don't understand what they're grieving. And a lot of parents want to be protective of their children and worry about their eternal life and issues like that. So it's so important to, you know, families to have a safe place to talk about their fears and concerns and go through this transition with someone who can guide them in a very non-judgmental and accepting way as they struggle to figure out this very something that parents never expect to have to do, you know?
Right. Well, I like your call to mental health providers to not kind of get in the way of what needs to happen in therapy with our own biases. I mean, this is why we all go to ethics trainings, you know, every single year, is that we need to look at our own biases. And part of why I felt it was so important to found the Mormon Mental Health Association is this issue of not exactly what you said, of not being tied to some type of result, you know, like we're going to have success with this client if they, you know, if they can stay in the church, you know, or we're going to have success with this client if I can change their orientation, or that's really not an appropriate stance to take as a therapist. And we can talk a little bit more about that when we talk about, you know, kind of healthier approaches to therapy. But I think this kind of, as Elliot, you've talked about in your bio, is this part of cultural competence, right? Of how do we address these issues within the cultural competence of Mormonism, but also the cultural competence of LGBTQ health. And that's a real challenge when sometimes those can seem very opposed. Let's move to this idea about how to move in the direction of ending conversion therapy. I mean, it's interesting. We've had some really, new things happening within our USA culture. I mean, several states have now made conversion therapy illegal within their state boundaries. I know that there was this lawsuit that happened, I think, in New Jersey, where it was conversion therapy was found to be a fraudulent type of therapy, kind of to your point, Judith, that it can't deliver on what it's promising. And so people are spending monies and energies on kind of from a consumer fraud perspective. So there's really starting to be a shift that is quite noticeable and palpable in our overall culture. And how do we continue to help that continue? And what roles do you see both the SAMHSA and the APA and reports like these playing in that?
That's a great question. I'm happy to kick us off. Judith, please feel free to chime in. So we thought about this quite a bit when we were putting together the report, and ended up dividing what we could come up with as mechanisms for ending conversion therapy into three prongs, which is really three separate target audiences. So the first is this idea of reducing discrimination and negative social attitudes generally in the environment. So this is what I call sort of the social change model. If you can make it something that is not stigmatized, we'll have better overall health for LGBTQ youth. A lot of the disparities that I mentioned earlier wouldn't happen. And also it might help end the desire for conversion therapy. Parents would stop seeing LGBTQ identities as something undesirable for their children and might be more comfortable with them on the whole. The second prong was sort of more targeted specifically towards providers, mental health providers. If we can provide accurate information about conversion therapy itself and how it's not effective and harmful, and we can provide information about actually, you know, how to support LGBTQ youth, which I think is something Judith's probably going to talk about more later, but I just wanted to highlight that, you know, when we were putting together this report, yes, the focus was really looking at conversion therapy, but it was also more broadly thinking about this idea that even like supportive and affirming providers often don't know what to do if, you know, a family is distressed about their, you know, child's LGBTQ identity, or they think maybe in this geographic area, in this community, in this faith culture, like, we're not sure how well that's going to work out with you. You get varying reactions. So if we can sort of do our best to pull together best practices and disseminate that information to families and providers everywhere, we'll sort of give LGBTQ youth a better shot at good outcomes, and also erode the idea that conversion therapy is beneficial in any way. And then the third prong is more what you talked about, and I think these have been the more publicly visible actions, which is, you know, I think targeting the people who are doing conversion therapy, you know, actively saying this practice should be banned because it's harmful, this practice is fraudulent, and things like that. But so from SAMHSA's, in terms of SAMHSA's ongoing efforts, I think this report was really the first in-depth federal look at the issue, and we wanted to focus on what we've done previously in other resources, which is really targeting the provider community and making sure that we can get good information out to them. But I am hopeful that it will serve as sort of a platform off of which SAMHSA and other folks across the country can start to think creatively about how to sort of address all three of these buckets of society.
And, you know, I love that section in the report that talks about, you know, policy solutions. I think we're very supportive of SAMHSA's efforts, and our big role, I think, in this was coming up with a scientific background and also coming up with an affirmative model that providers could adapt to their specific situation and specific clients that was based on sound psychological principles. And that I think in this case in particular was developmentally appropriate, because when you're working with children as young as 2 or 3 years old who may experience some sort of sense of my sense of myself and my gender doesn't fit the one identified at birth for me, you're dealing with very little children who have a different sense of, you know, developmentally they may not be able to grasp certain concepts. So we wanted something that would work across the spectrum of ages from like at birth to 18, so we could really help a child evolve and help families and therapists support that child through a complex developmental evolution. I mean, all parents know that their 2-year-old is different than their 16-year-old, and this issue is different depending on the age group, and the therapist has to be really, really well trained in child therapy and a whole bunch of other concerns in order to work with this population. So we're really concerned and put a great deal of emphasis on having an appropriate model, understanding how to assess these issues, and especially for gender identity and expression, understanding that the treatment needs to vary on the biological age of the child and their psychological and physical development. And that's extremely important.
And I just want to throw in there, I'm not sure if we've talked about this already, but Judith and Clinton Anderson at the APA deserve extraordinary amounts of thanks and credit for pulling together a convening of experts who pulled together consensus statements, sort of looking at all the things that Judith is talking about and deciding where they can come to consensus in the field. And part of that was addressing questions around gender identity and gender expression that hadn't been addressed before. So things like puberty suppression, which is you know, delaying puberty for youth who aren't sure yet whether or not they want to transition, or social transitions, the idea of having your child go to school or go out in public as the gender that they really feel that they are. So I just wanted to make sure that didn't get lost, that in terms of ending conversion therapy, one of the big contributions coming out of this report, I think, is the first publication of these consensus statements that really sort of take the temperature of where we are in the field now. And just, it's such an extraordinary tool for anyone who's really trying to get a sense of what people think is best for LGBTQ youth right now.
Well, thank you, Elliot. I just want to say, you know, we really tried to come up with some, I wouldn't call them clinical guidelines, but clinical principles so that people can know what is the best professional opinion right now, because we want families, church leaders, therapists to all be informed. So when someone recommends a certain practice, parents and even clergy members can sort of evaluate, well, wait a second, that doesn't fit with this set of guiding principles. Are you sure that's a good idea? And maybe pause. And, you know, we want parents to be educated consumers. We want older children to be educated consumers. So part of our goal in ending conversion therapy was to make sure that people knew the difference between what is recommended by professional associations and the experts and what isn't, so they can choose wisely for their children.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's the biggest part of why this report is so incredibly valuable, you know, is exactly everything that you're both mentioning, the background, the research, the clinical expertise. This is not just one person. This is a team approach of the best people who are so knowledgeable about these issues and giving a very comprehensive and clinically oriented, evidence-based, best standards approach, you know, to these issues, which is so important. And quite frankly, fits very well with Mormon culture in the sense of, you know, having the best technology, the best information, you know, truth seekers in a sense, right? I mean, we have some of the best doctors in Mormonism. You know, we're a very educated population for the most part. So we don't have this conflict like maybe other religions do with science or with higher education. Those things seem not to be in conflict as much within the Mormon culture. So this fits right into that perspective anyway, even though there's other parts of our culture that it doesn't fit into as well. But we do have that. And I just also want to say too that most psychological associations have come out with a position against reparative or conversion therapies, and that as we as professionals sign our codes of ethics, you know, to say, yes, I agree to abide by these codes, just like doctors abide by, you know, the laws of medicine, that I'm not going to allow my own religious or my own personal biases get in the way of treating people correctly, that we're signing to those positions as well, that we're not supposed to discriminate on things like sexual orientation, gender identity, things of that nature. And that's really important. And the Mormon Mental Health Association has come out with a position as well, against conservative or conversion therapies. So just to put that out there. All right. So two more questions before I kind of want to talk about how leaders in particular in our church can use this information. But really fast, I wanted to talk about, you know, you talk about taking an affirming approach to therapies. So I'd like for you to explain that a little bit, so that when people kind of go to their own therapists or seek out services, they kind of know what to look for. And then the second piece is we had talked about the possibility of still embracing your faith, even though there may be parts of the church culture that are not very LGBTQ friendly at this point. So those are kind of two big topics I'd like to touch on before we kind of wrap up.
Okay, well, maybe I'll start with the first one. So as I said before, you know, when you go to a therapist with questions about this, parents and children and adults should hope to get accurate, developmentally accurate information about sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. So anyone who then begins talking about, well, this is a sickness or a sin or this is contrary to the laws of nature, you automatically know that that's inaccurate. I mean, again, same gender sexual orientation and diversity and gender identity and expression are normal. So parents should expect to get that kind of message in an initial visit with a clinician. And also, the clinician should be able to tell parents, well, you know, there's some things we don't know. Like, even though a child is gender nonconforming, maybe at 3 or 4, we don't know the ultimate outcome of their sexual orientation or their gender identity and expression. You know, there are many different outcomes, and we can't predict what will happen. So parents, you know, can look at this material and say, okay, what am I hearing? Am I hearing that it's okay to love my child, that my child is normal? My child might be different from me and from others I see in the community, but they're still going to be okay somehow. I mean, that's the kind of message parents should look for. And again, they should avoid therapists who say, I can change your child, I can prevent them from growing up gay. They should avoid those types of messages. And I think they should look for a therapist who says, you know, it's okay to love your child. Or maybe your child is having trouble because they're feeling rejected in their school or in the community or by you. Let's talk about how you interact with them and how we can improve the interaction so that your child isn't depressed or angry. And the therapist should also be very, very concerned about the child's state of mind and make sure that the therapist looks at what the current problem is. Is the child depressed? Is the child anxious? Is there a risk of suicide? I mean, the therapist should be really, really concerned, not so much about the child's sexual orientation or gender identity expression, but what is the real mental health problem they're struggling with? Are they facing bullying? Are they being traumatized at school or on a sports team? That's what the concern should be. So the therapist shouldn't have an a priori sort of sense of what the outcome will be. They should be affirming in terms of LGBT lives. They should be open-ended about the outcome, and they should be willing to talk to the family about ways they can support and affirm their child. And those are some of the basic foundations of what we're looking for a model. And they should also be open to considering faith and trying to figure out how to weave those two things together, sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, and faith, and help the parents sort of sort through the key precepts of their faith and how to work with those in moving forward.
Okay, Elliot, do you have any thoughts about either of those questions?
No, I think Judith hit all of the nails on all of the heads.
One question that I'll just ask more specifically, because this question comes up quite a bit, I think, in social media, and especially with all the attention that Caitlyn Jenner has received, you know, through the transgender issue in particular, is this concept of when is it too early? And you kind of touched on it, Judith, as far as when is it too early to identify as transgender, or when is it too early to start things such as hormone replacement therapies or, you know, even surgical kind of interventions? Because some of the literature that I've read is that puberty is a difficult time, in particular for transgender adolescents, because they're already not feeling comfortable with their body, and now their body is maturing in ways that, you know, that they're not identifying with. And so when hormone replacement therapies are early on through adolescence, that can be very helpful for transgender youth. But then there's this pushback that it's too early, they're not developed enough, they're not mature enough to make those kinds of decisions for themselves. So there seems to be a real conflict about what best practices around that. And I know I'm maybe tangenting a little bit from what we're talking about in general, but I think it's an important thing to talk about if both of you would have some expertise on that.
I think the report goes into the details. I think when you're dealing with very young children, so prepubescent children, it's really hard to know what a diverse gender expression means. I mean, you know, a 2 or 3 year old really doesn't have an evolved sense of their gender identity yet. They may experience some sort of gender dysphoria or they may not. But what we see is a diverse gender expression. And a lot of times what we suggest is the parents be accepting of that and not try to force the child to be traditionally male or female into that binary model. And to, you know, work with the school and the community to be tolerant of the child's exploration. Sometimes it will resolve itself, or sometimes the child will continue to be diverse in the way they express themselves. And as you note, as the child ages, you will see more and more, and I think this is where the help of a skilled professional is so important, you'll sort of see where the child goes. Some children will continue to experience sort of a sense of gender dysphoria or unease. Other children will just be feel gender diverse and be comfortable with a sort of an open-ended sense of themselves. And I think if the child still experiences gender dysphoria at the edge of puberty, that's when I think a qualified psychologist or social worker or psychiatrist and then an endocrinologist need to be brought in to have the discussion about whether gender suppression is appropriate to reduce distress and to help the child really figure out and be sure about whether a transition, what kind of transition makes sense for them. I think it's often important not to push a child to transition. I mean, I think the parents need to not sort of move the child in any way, the same with the therapist. A gender-diverse child may not go to transition, or they may. I think it's really important to be very open-ended, to not push in either way, but to be accepting enough if the child seems distressed at the, you know, prior to the onset of puberty, consider gender suppression. And then I think towards the end of adolescence, most people are accepting of more intensive biological or surgical interventions if the child chooses to transition. Elliot may have some other things to add, but I really encourage people to read the specifics of the report because that goes into it in much more detail. And there's a very good bibliography that provides some source material and some studies about these issues.
Yeah, I would like to add just a couple of things. So as Judith mentioned, we have some specific information in the report about things like, you know, at what stage in puberty might you consider hormone blockers or cross-sex hormones. So there's a specific section called Affirmative Care for Gender Minority Youth that I would encourage folks to read. But it is not, and was by design, not a set of clinical protocols. It just wasn't the group that we pulled together. It wasn't the question that we were trying to answer. So there are several resources that people could turn to. The first is the University of California, San Francisco, I think UCSF, has a Center for Excellence of Transgender Health that is a great resource for transgender health-related protocols, as well as the World Professional Association for Transgender Health could be very helpful. There are a number of specialty clinics also that work with transgender youth. Several of the members of the consensus panel specialize in working with transgender youth, so you could find their names in the report and reach out to them. But the other thing I just want to highlight, which is also something that we talk about in the report, is for transgender youth in particular, coping with these kinds of issues bring up not only behavioral health concerns, but also physical health concerns. So a pediatrician is often sort of the first point of entry for many families into dealing with all health-related issues. You know, they've developed a trusting relationship. They go to the pediatrician. They're looking for maybe a referral to a mental health professional. One thing we just wanted to stress in the report is that even for very affirming families who are hoping to sort of help their transgender youth transition, it's really important to develop a team of care that involves mental health because of all the things that Judith was talking about in terms of uncertainties relating to, you know, developmental trajectories and whether or not youth want to transition, when should they transition socially or otherwise. It's just really important to make sure that, you know, even if you are a family that's confident that you want to help your kid transition, it's really helpful to have a mental health professional be part of a team.
No, I think that's very helpful because, again, when we say LGBTQ, I mean, each one of those have kind of their own intricacies, right? Their own issues to kind of sort out. And so it's a big, we're lumping in a lot of people and a lot of different things into one podcast per se, but I think it's just important to talk about a little bit of that. So I think a lot of what you both mentioned as far as what's helpful for families would also be helpful for ecclesiastical leaders. But I would like to kind of spend the last little bit here, maybe more directed towards people like LDS bishops, stake presidents, young men's and young women's leaders who are oftentimes, you know, in very much in the throw of things as kids deal with a lot of these things in adolescence, but even primary leaders, because I know of some transgender children who are at least socially dressing, you know, the other gender. And so they're, the primary leaders are the ones who are dealing with the children and how they can be supportive. So there's just a lot, I think, that, and especially in the wake of some of the policies that have been coming forth from overall leadership. So they're in a tricky situation, I think, a lot of our local leaders, you know, to try to be obviously supportive of their religion and their sustaining of their, you know, overall leaders, but at the same time, sustaining and supportive of the people that they're finding in their congregation. So any thoughts that would specifically apply to that population?
Well, I'll start out and then I'm sure Elliot will jump in. I think it's important to realize that due to the immense uncertainty that you know, leaders of faith or people in advisory roles maybe should not assume that just because a child is different that there's going to be some awful outcome later in life, that they can help by getting accurate information, realizing there's tremendous uncertainty, and embracing that child and their family with accepting messages and not jumping to, oh my God, your child's going to be gay when they grow up. You have to try to change them now. I mean, I think it's up to our lay leaders, to members of the clergy, to be informed and to sort of focus on the key sort of, I think, value that many people find in their faith of love, family, and community, and the sense of strength that they get from being part of a community, and to try to maintain both the child and the family within the community with messages of, you know, we realize you're on a journey, we know this journey is uncertain, but we will try to accompany you on that and help you get the assistance you need from qualified professionals to help you make decisions along the way. And I think that would be a wonderful role for people engaged with youth to come up with and be aware of this terrific resource and therapists who are well-trained within the LDS community who can provide families some sound advice, but not to jump to any conclusions and to be very careful to avoid rejecting behaviors or judgmental behaviors that can lead to so much distress. And I also think since bullying is such a big problem with youth and children, that really saying no to bullying and making sure that the environment in youth groups and within the faith is, it doesn't have to be embracing and saying gay is okay, but it shouldn't be condemnatory. It shouldn't be rejecting. And I think we can all agree that taking the high road and speaking in terms of treating everyone with respect is important as we, you know, really struggle with changing times.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. I would add, I think, just reflecting on what we know about the experience of LGBTQ youth now, which is, you know, higher rates of depression, anxiety, suicidality, bullying and harassment, sort of all the things that I talked about earlier, I think that really needs to be distinguished from what seems like a more of an upper level policy decision about same gender marriage. And I think those decisions do have ripple effects down throughout a community that can be very harmful, but also don't have to be relevant to the day-to-day life of children and adolescents. You know, so I think for leaders in the community who are working with families or working with LGBTQ youth or really all children, because I think there's this really painful decision that, you know, children of same gender couples are being asked to make in terms of reflecting on and rejecting their parents' relationships. I think if we can stay focused on the present and sort of help make sure that all of our communities are whole and healthy and happy and supported, then sort of decisions that they'll have to make as adults about whether and how to live their lives can happen later. But the way things are now, in terms of depression, anxiety, and suicidality, later is not always something that we can take for granted in this community. And I would like to make that be less true. So I think that is an area where leaders in the community can be very helpful.
Yes. I think that's a wonderful point that these are real people. They're not abstract policies, and we need to treat them as real people and meet them as another human being with compassion, rather than think of it as an abstract policy that's come down on high. I think that's so important. That's a great point that Elliot makes.
Yeah, I agree. And just some things I would add, just kind of knowing my own culture, is, you know, a call for not disciplining LGBTQ youth differently than heterosexual youth would be disciplined, not making discipline about their orientation or their attraction or their gender, their gender spectrum. And so that's one thing I would call for. I think that there's lots of, even the higher leadership has said that really local leadership has a lot of control and how they go through with policies, and they know their congregations best. And so I would really call to local leaders to understand that policies are not necessarily doctrine, and that they have some jurisdiction about how they want to proceed in ways that are really meeting the best needs of the congregants and their wards and stakes. And I think that a lot of stake leaders are very much able to bring in either trainings for bishops or trainings for overall wards and or ward councils, where you are bringing in professionals who have the type of affirmative approaches that you've described today, to better educate those who are dealing directly with youth and congregants and who are not really professionally trained to do so. And that's a challenge that we have in our church. I mean, I think it's wonderful that we have this lay leadership of people who just volunteer and fill all these roles. But at the same time, there is this problematic aspect of that you have people giving advice or holding worthiness interviews or making decisions without a lot of professional training, if any. And so I think that those are just some basic suggestions that I would give. Again, the Mormon Mental Health Association, one of our goals is to help be a resource for ecclesiastical leaders, and we definitely want to be collaborative in that way, and we vet our clinicians that are on the directories to make sure that they are, you know, LGBTQ affirming and able to, if they're going to work in that arena, that they're able to do so in these types of approaches that you've delineated today. So those are some of the things, and I will make sure and link to everything that you've mentioned as well, as far as resources and this report, when the podcast comes out. So given that, is there anything that either one of you want to say as far as just like last statements and, kind of giving me your closing thoughts?
Well, first, thank you for having this. I feel this is so important, and I feel like your remarks at the end were so important. You know, we need to treat these issues like they're complex medical problems, because they are. And I think, you know, lay individuals wouldn't give advice about surgery or do surgery, and so perhaps it's important to think about it that way, that you refer to a competent mental health provider, because it's really hard to know what to say or do. But that communities and families can play a very important role in children's lives by providing love and support and avoiding rejection and condemnation. And that is really so important for LGBT youth and questioning children as they evolve, to know that they do have a community of faith and their family to rely on as they try to navigate these really complicated issues. And, you know, our association welcomes collaboration with diverse individuals, you know, and communities of faith as we try to move forward to provide the best care for children and their families.
Yeah, I'm echoing Judith. I just wanted to say thank you for having this conversation. It's been a pleasure to participate, and I think it is so important to have conversations across the country like this. We're very, very pleased to have been able to put out this report, but we know that it is sort of a first step. I really hope that it serves as a platform for a lot of future work. And to the extent that you're interested in or wanting to collaborate, SAMHSA is happy to continue being a resource on this.
Yes, thank you. I know that that's another thing that I just want to put out there for leaders, is that you can always contact SAMHSA directly, and they'll, you know, direct you to local resources or resources that they have even federally. I mean, this is where a lot of our tax dollars go, and we can make use of that for sure by taking advantage of these resources available to us. So thank you again both so much for your time. This has been a pivotal conversation and so important for the LDS audience to be open to. So thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll. Hiding round. Treacherous shore, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Boisterous way,
boisterous way.
Obey thy will,
obey thy will.
When thou say, wondrous sovereign of the sea, Jesus, Savior, pilot me. When at last twixt me and,
twixt me and
the peaceful rest,
the peaceful rest.
Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear thee say to me, fear not I.